Welcome back to Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and this is to air on Thanksgiving Day, so happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Now, when you think about it, isn't it strange to have an annual holiday in the United States of America in which people are encouraged to give thanks to God on this day? And this is a tradition that runs deep in American soil. It gets back, of course, to the Pilgrims, as we discussed with Paul Jaley. President Washington was the first president to call for a day of Thanksgiving in late November 1789, to take place in November 89. President Lincoln made it an annual holiday. But somebody might say, well, doesn't this violate the separation of church and state? Well, in this part of Vocal Point, we're going to talk about that issue of separation of church and state and about Thomas Jefferson, from whom we get the phrase separation of church and state, and actually deal with some of the misunderstandings surrounding him and his faith. Now, I had the privilege of co-writing my 25th book that I've either written or co-written, and this one was with Dr. Mark Blyles, and it is called Doubting Thomas, The Religious Life and Legacy of Thomas Jefferson. And Mark Blyles joins us now. And by the way, for more information on the book, doubtingthomasbook.com. Mark, welcome to the program, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, Jerry. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Okay, thank you. So the phrase separation of church and state, I'm sure many of our listeners know that doesn't come from the Constitution. It comes rather from, a private letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote. But that doesn't mean many Americans know that fact. In fact, I doubt that many do. I've seen some videos where people have asked man in the street basic questions about American history. I mean, really basic questions, and they get those wrong, much less this idea.
Yeah, it's something that there's widespread misunderstanding about Jefferson and about separation of church and state because of basically a letter he wrote to Baptists in Connecticut while he's president, and that was a phrase that mentioned a wall of separation of church and state. But the Supreme Court and many people today take it out of context and totally turn it upside down as to its meaning.
Well, okay, let's talk a little bit about Thomas Jefferson and his faith. But before we do that, give us a little bit about your own personal background. I think as a pastor in Charlottesville, and then you're also involved in the Providence Foundation, which you helped found with Stephen McDowell. Tell us about some of the things that you found there in Charlottesville that show that, hey, you know, there's this Reverend Charles Clay that we've not heard about, and we need to know about him if we want to know about Jefferson's faith, etc.
Yes, by living in Charlottesville, Jefferson's hometown, and where also the University of Virginia was founded by Jefferson's through his efforts, I've been forced to sort of, as a result of all of those influences, listen to what people say Jefferson believed and did, and for so many years tried to finally figure out, well, what is the real truth, and go back to original sources. I started doing that, worked on a PhD and did research on that religion in this area. And there's amazing things that most people have never heard about. Indeed, like the fact that Jefferson, just 6 months after signing the Declaration of Independence, drafting that draft of that document, he turns around and then drafts a founding document for a church right here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it was called the Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville, and its pastor was Charles Clay. He was an unusual man because he was an evangelical Anglican, very rare in those times, but kind of born out of the Great Awakening, and his sermons sound like, you know, Jonathan Edwards kinds of sermons that, in fact, we've printed in our book a couple of those.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's my understanding that those two sermons in the appendix of Doubting Thomas, The Religious Life and Legacy of Thomas Jefferson, the book that we produce, that's the first time ever in book form that you've got at least any sermon from, you know, the Reverend Charles Clay, much less two. And here's a man that Jefferson supported. And by the way, there's even a picture or a facsimile in our book showing that document that you're referring to, founding document of the church that Jefferson himself wrote. And I understand he was the chief supporter among lay people. Or in other words, he gave more money than any other layperson for that particular church.
That's right. His name was the first on the list to pledge support, and he did so Throughout the revolutionary period and the war for independence, it was a church that he supported and interacted with its pastor. And at one point, he even wrote glowing commendations for Reverend Clay. And so it's a very amazing time that of Jefferson's life that we never hear about. It doesn't fit the paradigm of most modern biographers of Jefferson, so I think, unfortunately, they just sort of ignore it.
Well, would it be safe to say that Jefferson, by the end of his life, had a lot of doubts about basic Christian doctrines, or even just, frankly, unbelief about some of the basic Christian doctrines, at least privately he did, so that as an older man, he couldn't have written that document for that church in Charlottesville. But by the same token, he might not have been able to write the Declaration of Independence or the Virginia Statute the same way either. And that might not have been passed either, by the way.
True. I mean, definitely over the course of his life, he was a man constantly changing in different ways. And some of that was of his own, you know, making, but a lot of it was influenced by different movements in his hometown and in the country. And Unitarianism was a growing movement that up north, and John Adams and others were swept into it. But then, and Jefferson seemed to agree with that in the last, you know, last 13, 15 years of his life at least. And that's clearly, you know, you see sort of the rejection of the Trinity and these other things. Although, having said that, and definitely as viewers should know, you know, listeners should know that certainly when we talk about doubting Thomas in this book, we're put a question mark behind that. Doubting Thomas so as to some extent, call into question the prevailing views of Jefferson, but clearly we do not deny some of those troubling statements he made late in life.
Mm-hmm.
And even doing so, we must always remember he never left the church. He, in fact, recommitted as soon as a pastor came to town of the Episcopal Church, a Trinitarian church. He supported that pastor and until his death, and was buried in the church as a member in good standing.
Hmm. In fact, Herb Titus, who earned his doctorate of law at Harvard, he used to be a bad guy in the sense he was an ACLU attorney. Then he got saved. Then he went on to actually be the founding dean of the Regent Law School for Pat Robertson. And that was a major, major role. And thankfully, he endorsed this book. But he made a point that, look, it is just so wrong to take the Jefferson, let's say, who was a later skeptic in life, and then, impose that ideology on the Jefferson of 1776, 1777. It's just wrong. It's just bad history.
That's true. And the thing that, without a doubt, we have to be thankful for on this Thanksgiving Day is the fact that because of Thomas Jefferson's influence, we have, from the Declaration of Independence onward, a government that has recognized God, that has acknowledged divine providence, that has, clearly been a non-secular idea of government, a government that actually rooted its rights in God, and that has produced for our country a much better result than, say, a country like the Soviet Union and others in modern times that reject all influence of God in their government.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just to give a quick overview of the book, if I may, after an introduction, there are basically five chapters where we focus on five different stages of Jefferson's life. Then we take three of his major accomplishments, the very ones that he said, this is what I want to be remembered for, writing the Declaration, writing the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom in 1777 is when he wrote it. It was adapted in 1786, finally. And then also founding the University of Virginia, which he did in the early 1800s. Those three legacies. And we show how those, what they really were in history. And then we deal with three chapters dealing with those same three legacies, only how they've been distorted later. And so now, instead of the separation of church and state the way Jefferson envisioned it, we have today the separation of God and state, and in some cases state-sanctioned atheism. And, you know, a Christian group can't meet in the campus when a different type of group, a chess club, can meet because that violates the separation of church and state. Oh, by the way, the Supreme Court even dealt with these things and has often been a lot more pro-Christian and pro-freedom towards Christian expression than a lot of these school administrators. But we're stuck with this because of this misreading of Thomas Jefferson, and it seems to impact us every day.
That's very true. We have a very distorted understanding, and I think that's what we are calling our readers of this book to do, to go back and re-examine this, look at more evidence than perhaps they've seen. You know, and this part of the great contribution of our book is that we introduce evidence that no one has ever seen. There are over 50 letters that Jefferson wrote dealing with religion that it were never printed until today, until this year, with this book and another collection of letters that I printed earlier in the year. And so, you know, there really is a reason to rethink the common distorted view of Jefferson.
Okay, now, let me ask you this. Why don't you explain for us Jefferson, federalism versus the state thing, that on the one hand, he had no problem at all as governor of Virginia to declare a day of prayer and so forth. But as president, over the federal government, he felt that that was inappropriate. Not that he was against expression of God in the public arena. He just, drew a line there. Can you explain that? It's kind of tricky.
Yeah, it is. And that's what a lot of people miss. When he was governor of Virginia, he had no problem proclaiming, in fact, a day of Thanksgiving for it to be observed by the people of his state. And so that was, first off, remember that on this day of national Thanksgiving, that Jefferson called people to give thanks to God as governor. And so he saw no problem with that sort of general non-denominational kind of promotion of religion by the state. But when he received these letters from Baptists and supporters while he was president, that's what he said. He decided he would not proclaim national days of prayer or Thanksgiving because he felt it kind of usurped or interfered with the rights of states to decide how they wanted to deal with religion. So that was his thinking. It wasn't a secularism that he was his motive, but a federalism. And in fact, that was what he was known for. His presidency in general was empowering states' rights, sort of limiting government. And this was his philosophy. And so the religious question was what he did. Now, we have examples in the federal territories where he had direct authority over while president. He had no problem promoting religion besides first off, just right in the capital, Washington, D.C. That was a federal territory. It had no state government that it would interfere with, and so he saw no problem to attend religious services and support them in the capital. In that,
yeah, let's just
government building.
Stop you right there. In the U.S. Capitol, from about 1800 until about the 1880s, there were Christian worship services on any given Sunday in the U.S. Capitol, and Jefferson, while he was president, attended those on a regular basis, and there's all kinds of eyewitnesses. And I mentioned that to a friend of mine, and he said, well, what about the separation of church and state? And I said, well, Jefferson didn't have the same perspective, and he's the source from which we even get the very phrase, separation of church and
state. Right.
And for those who have just joined us, we're talking with Mark Belisles, with whom I co-wrote a book called Doubting Thomas, The Religious Life and Legacy of Thomas Jefferson. DoubtingThomasBook.com for more information. But why don't you address that that comment about the Capitol? I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, first off, in our book, we talk about a letter that Jefferson wrote to the chaplains of Congress, specifically saying, hey, I have a friend who's a Presbyterian preacher named John Glendy that is going to be in town next week. Can you make space, allow him to preach the sermon in the Capitol? There's a letter in 1804 where he requests this, and he boasts about this in a couple other letters to friends how he arranged all of this. This is the President Jefferson, arranging for preaching of a Presbyterian of all things right in the Capitol. And there's other things too where he sets up arrangements for the government to fund some missionaries in their work among Indians, Catholics. There was a Catholic minister named, you know, out in Detroit that he gave arrangements to give funding to for his Christian schools. There was a Presbyterian minister among the Cherokees down in Tennessee that he gave money to. He did all this through the Secretary of War because it was a means of promoting peace, but it was clearly supporting religion, as well as Quakers and Moravian, the United Brethren for the propagation of the gospel to the Indians. So there was a number of ways in which he did this in federal territories and saw no problem. He also wrote a letter to a bunch of Catholics in Louisiana right after, you know, purchasing that territory. The Louisiana territory, he wrote to some Ursuline nuns in New Orleans and said, I promise you that my government will give you all the protection and the patronage that you need, and so you don't have to worry about that. And so there's an example of him, you know, directly, you know, encouraging, saying his government would help them. So a lot of things on the national, as long as it didn't interfere in state authority, he saw no problem with encouraging religious expression.
I have here open to page 206 in this 500 or so page book. Here are just a few samples. 1804, he signed an act that approved the payment of chaplains for the government. In 1805, in his second inaugural address, he said that religious exercises according to the Constitution are under the direction and discipline of state or church authorities. And he went on to say, join me in supplication that he, that is God, will enlighten the minds of your servants, guide their counsels. In 1806, he gave $50, which, by the way, back then was a lot of money, to the order of Governor Wilkinson or other acting governor of Louisiana for building a church there. In 1807, he said an accusation that he, quote-unquote, wanted government to be without religion, quote-unquote, was a lie. And it goes on and on. I mean, I'm just reading a few samples from this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, right there, that one you mentioned. He gave money to the governor of Louisiana for building a church there down in New Orleans. You know, that clearly, you know, shows that he had no problem with that intersection of government and religion directly in building a church. Just amazing.
Well, explain that then, because what's his understanding? What was Jefferson's understanding of separation of church and state? Not that he should be the only arbiter of separation of church and state or of what the Constitution means, because he wasn't even there when they wrote the Constitution, and he wasn't there when they wrote the First Amendment.
Well, I think there's sort of three things. First off, again, is we already talked about federalism, his idea that keep the national government out of the way and let states decide such policies. But in general, we kind of talk about his legacy in three ways in our book. One is that he believed that government should be non-secular. He clearly put God into official documents, so he didn't want a secular expression of government. Second, he wanted non-coercive religion. As long as religion didn't use state power to enforce other people to believe something or to pay for something, then he supported it. So non-coercive religion. And the third was what I would call non-denominational education. He was founding the University of Virginia. Here was a state, publicly funded university that he thought, as long as we, you know, make it fair for all the denominations to attend, and no one divinity school favors one particular denomination or something, he says, then that's what we should try to do in a state university. That gives you an idea. He just felt like creating more of a even playing field, get the government out of the way, and let the free market in the states determine kind of how religion would be handled. That's so opposite from the ACLU types and the modern kind of people who are always running to the courts, running to government, trying to get the government to make policy. It's so un-Jeffersonian. Jefferson would, you know, even if he objected to some things late in life, he didn't run to government to stop it. He appealed to, you know, popular opinion. And that's really the Jeffersonian idea and the American idea.
Jefferson wrote something called the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. I've already mentioned it a little bit here and there. But this is a very important document. He wrote it in 1777, the same year he wrote that the agreement for the establishment of that church in Charlottesville, which was a, an evangelical Protestant church. And this Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, some have said it was essentially a forerunner to the First Amendment, which guaranteed religious freedom. But listen to some of the points he made in it. It's really got a theological base. I'm going to quote some of it. Almighty God hath created the mind free. All attempts to influence it by temporal punishments or burdens or by civil incapacitations tend only to beget habits of hypocrisy and meanness, and are a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, who, being Lord both of body and mind, yet choose not to propagate it by coercions on either, as was in his almighty power to do. Now, wait a minute. Did I read that right? The holy author of our religion. Who could that be? Yeah. Who does Jefferson talk about? No, by the way, he wrote that in 1777, and then later he wrote an autobiography, and I believe it was 1821, and then he said that the legislature later, and this would have happened when he was in France, said they wanted to put the words Jesus Christ in there, but he said that that was voted down, thus this freedom of, you know, of religion applies to everybody, the Hindu, the Muslim, or however he described that, the Mohammedan, I think he said, the Jew, the Christian, everybody. Explain this about this holy author of our religion.
Yeah, it's quite obvious this was referring to the dominant religion in Virginia and in the United States, which was Christianity. Clearly, the person that they all were, you know, reciting knew was meant here was Jesus. And so he was saying that model of Jesus, not the model of Muhammad or others who might have used the state, but the model of Jesus was to basically allow freedom. And this is the approach he took in this document. It's, you know, we can see, interestingly enough, just 2 years later, he also, while governor, proclaimed a day of public thanksgiving and prayer, and referred there to, in that proclamation, that people, you know, gather and thank the Redeemer. He talked about, you know, for our, you know, for the forgiveness of our sins and many other blessings. He talked about that he urged people to pray for the ministers of the gospel to receive the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, and that he would bless and spread the light of Christian knowledge throughout the remotest corners of the earth. There's no question it's the author of our religion is Jesus Christ.
I understand that Jefferson was very generous to Christian causes.
Yes. I mean, it's one of the things that's really interesting. In our book, we show evidence of this, is that Jefferson, not only did he attend church his whole life, there's an evidence of that, but he supported many other churches. There's at least 70 or more examples of him making donations to various churches and religious groups, and it was usually always where he lived. He, whether in his hometown of Charlottesville, different churches he gave to, or in Washington, D.C., and even in Philadelphia when he was there a little bit. And so we have in his memorandum books so many examples of this. There's probably, you know, again, about at least 70 different clergymen or churches that clear proof in his memorandum books of giving money.
Oh, well, they're all liberal. What if somebody said that? Oh, well, yeah, he gave to Unitarian ministers.
Only one would be considered unorthodox out of all of those.
Really?
Only one out of 70 would be a person that we would call, you know, sort of a person who rejected maybe the Trinity.
How about his correspondence? Was that all with Unitarians?
It's a very similar kind of dynamic. You can see there's we've documented over 200 clergymen that he corresponded with, sent letters to, and in our church groups, and in those, well over 90% are Orthodox Christian groups or clergymen. Under 10% were unorthodox. And yet, you know what was so interesting, Jerry, is that in almost every biography of Jefferson that you find today, the one letters that are quoted are to those that are under 10% of the unorthodox quotes.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that you always hear about. And that's why this sort of distorted image is created. People blow one kind of set of letters or quotations out of proportion And that's what we want to try to prove. We don't deny those, but those, mm-hmm. but we put them in the context of the other 90%.
And not only that, but there's the most obnoxious things that Jefferson ever wrote, questioning key Christian doctrines in private letters, were actually in portions of letters not even sent. So, you know,
true.
Imagine if you wrote something, you have a copy of it, and then you rewrite it, and the part that you didn't send then gets quoted later by historians, you know, 200 years later, as if that reflected your views, and yet there's a reason you didn't send it. Maybe you didn't ever want it to see it in print or something. But we're almost out of time, and I've got to get to the issue of the Bible. And I do want to mention one thing, since we've brought up Unitarianism. The Unitarianism of 1820, let's say, was not the Unitarianism of today. It was a lot more biblically oriented. I don't agree with it. I totally agree with Athanasius and the Trinitarianism, but I still just want to say that that some of the Unitarians in those days were Bible-oriented and so forth. But speaking of the Bible, comment on Jefferson and the Bible.
Yeah, like you said, a number of the most commonly quoted things that people talk about Jefferson today are the things that he never sent, letters he never sent, or were collections of notes that he never showed a single soul. And his collection of the Gospels, his abridgment of the Gospels, was one of those documents. He never showed it to a single person, and yet people, first off, think it's almost as if he was an advocate of rejecting the Bible and all these other things.
Or the miracles.
He never showed it
to
a single person, right. And that's a part of it, too, that's a misunderstanding, is that what was the motivation? He clearly makes it evident in the title, in his own words, for this collection in 1804 while president, that this was an abridgment designed for the use of the Indians. You remember, he had just purchased the Louisiana Territory, and missionaries write to him. We have evidence of this correspondence urging him to support their work now to reaching out to all these thousands of new tribal groups. And he kind of responds and says, you know, why don't we just at least get out just the words of Jesus? It'll be a little more simple. And that was really the motivation. It wasn't rejecting all miracles, as a lot of people claim, but rather just creating a digest of the morals, the philosophy of Jesus. And by indirectly, all the actions of Jesus were left out.
No.
Actually, saying all is not even true. A few references to miracles are still in that collection.
So it wasn't necessarily downplaying the miracles so much as it was just promoting the teachings without the actions. But one is left with the impression that it could be downplaying the miracles.
Yeah, if you take it out of the context of everything else, but we also have to remember he was a lifetime donor to the Virginia Bible Society, to get whole Bibles out to people throughout Virginia and even down in Louisiana and other places like that. So to think that he was not for getting the whole Bible out would be a misconstruction of what this digest was all about.
All right. Now, also in 1819, 1820, for his own personal edification, I understand that he did kind of the same basic thing. He took a lot of the statements of Jesus Christ. He put in English those teachings on the left-hand column, then he had another column, and he had the teachings of Christ in Greek, then another one in Latin, and another one in French, all of these being the same verses, just in these different languages, as he would study
right.
them. So he was basically studying the teachings of Jesus, including things like, do
yeah.
unto others as you would have them, do unto you, and, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, and so forth. But as you say, he didn't edit out all the miracles, but there are certainly, you know, there's not an emphasis on that either.
Right. He was simply kind of focusing on the words of Jesus. And you know, one of the things that's really important is he shared this idea with his lifelong kind of pastoral friend, Reverend Clay, that evangelical preacher. And
yes, we have less than a minute to go. We have less than a minute to go. Go ahead.
And when he shared about this, what his little digest that he made, his pastor said, well, just make sure you don't publish it, because his pastor wrote a letter to him, because other people will not understand your good intentions. And as I understand you, to not be an enemy of Christianity, of religion. And I think that's an important perspective from a pastor of his own time, and that we ourselves miss today and we need to get back.
Jefferson was a hero to the evangelicals of Virginia in his day. And most people don't even realize that. Or not just the evangelicals of Virginia, but the Evangelicals of America because he was so strong for religious freedom. Well, Mark, thanks so much sharing with us. Again, for more information, DoubtingThomasBook.com. DoubtingThomasBook.com. Mark Belials and Jerry Newcomb are the authors. Mark, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and to all your listeners.
All right. Thank you now. And bye-bye.